Welcome home. We are WNST. AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We are Baltimore Positive. We are positively here in beautiful Catonsville. Right across from the fire department, we're at it's Beaumont, the Beaumont near Beaumont Avenue. Google it up. It's a beautiful place right across from State Fair in El Guapo. I've had a delicious lunch start. We had a little chicken pesto wrap kind of thing. We're doing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour. It's all brought to you by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. This is a first ticket. This is ticket 00, Back to the Future, calling out the DeLorean. And top prize is $10,000. So I'm giving these away. We'll be on Wednesday at Cooper's North in Timonium by the racetrack. And then we're going to be at Coco's Pub in Lauraville on the 30th. And in White Marsh at Red Brick Station, drinking some blueberry ale on the 7th of May. My Kemosabe, lifer friend, rock star buddy John Allen here, playing M3 with David Lee Roth.
Hey, look at all the people here tonight.
Give that girl a backstage pass, yeah. How are you? What Stone Horses on the road, right? Back out, and then we got the Child's Play thing happening here. You're busy, basically, right?
Yeah, pretty busy. Yeah, we did the Stone Horses a tour with Steel Panther before Christmas, right up to Christmas, basically.
All over the East Coast, right? You were like in 7 or 8 states, like all sort of places, right?
Yeah, we went as far as into the Midwest, Minneapolis and Milwaukee and Chicago and, yeah, Boston, all the House of Blues, like great venues, great Live Nation. I mean, a lot of people, you know, some people, you know, gripe about them. They were so good to us because we were considered a baby band, and they had this program called On the Road Again, and they slid us an extra $1,500 almost every show that we did on that. Every Live Nation show that we did was one of those shows, and it was a really nice surprise, you know, to help us out with gas and everything. And wound up, we were able to get a tour bus the second half of the tour. And it's really saved me because I was exhausted.
Well, I was going to, just in a general sense, when a band gets to, you're a youngish band, you're a guy that's been in a couple of bands, you're trying to establish a band, there's no more record companies, you know, you're trying to get played in internet places, and even, you know, heritage places like 98 Rock or whatever, 100.7, to pick your song up or play you or have you in the studio or talk about it. But then there's the act of going out on the road.
Right.
And 10 years ago, and this is a long time ago in our age, but 10 years ago, I did 30 ballparks in 30 days. And, you know, relying on Southwest Airlines, relying on rental cars, relying on the games that actually happened and the weather, hotels, back and forth. That's a different kind of like what George Thorogood did 100 years ago, 50 states, 50 days, which was the inspiration for me to do it. I did radio in certain cities in certain ways in my hotel room, and I organized it all for a month. And when I came home, I was so exhausted that I didn't even go to the Rush last shows ever that they ever did was that summer. I was just like, I'm home. I'm not going anywhere. And I love airplanes. I like traveling. I'm not a bitchy traveler. I'm not bitchy when the room's not ready. I'm not bitchy when the flight. I don't bitch about that. I mean, I'm good. I feel like it's one of the great modern things to see the world. But at this point, to get on a tour bus and go around for any band that I ever see that does it, that's over the age of 40, just period, right? No matter how old you are. Go-Go's are out touring right now with Gina, right? Mm-hmm. But you get 6, 8, 10, 12 shows in it's December, and you haven't done it in a while, in your case, right? Mm-hmm. You're leading a band, you're playing clubs. I can't imagine just the voice and the physical part of being out on the road once you get to show 6, 8, 10. Do you get groovy, or do you get fatigued at this point?
I started to get fatigued, honestly. I mean, it was, you know, it's all about sleep, and it's all about being quiet, you know, like, and I'm a talker like you, so.
And people want to talk to you after the show.
Unfortunately, I'll pound caffeine before the show to have energy for the show, and then like you come off stage and you're wide awake, you know, and it's the middle of the night, and, you know, so I'm happy to talk.
And you're
to
on
people.
A bus.
I'm happy to talk to people at that point. Yeah. Well, then, when you get on the bus, it's a different story. I was actually able to sleep. It was a savior, but I will say that you know, bus living is not as glamorous as, you know, people think, especially the older you get. I mean, when you're, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old, it's like, wow, this is great. But even then, it kind of, the luster wears off rather quickly, especially if the toilet, you know, like system backs up and you start smelling it smells like you're driving around
eats too many onions.
In a 40-foot, you know, outhouse, basically, is what a tour bus is like sometimes. Like, we were just talking before air about Bon Jovi when I was with SR71 and we did the Bon Jovi tour. Those guys did it a lot differently. They would set up a hub and say, like, if we were doing a bunch of Midwest dates, they would set up in a luxury hotel in Chicago, and then they would take their little G6 or whatever jet it was, and they would fly to the different
locations.
Elton
John did that. He would either live in Las Vegas or Atlanta, and he would fly to all the shows, right?
I think Zeppelin were the first ones to do that. So it was like we started the tour on the West Coast, and they set up in, like, you know, San Jose or something, and then we're tour busing it. There were a couple of shows out there in the West where those cities are really far apart. We just barely made it to the gigs. Like, you know, we got there at, like, I don't know, 6:30, threw the gear on stage and hit stage at 7 o'clock for our 25-minute set or 20-minute set. You know, but
drive 20 hours, play 20 minutes.
Oh my god, yeah. It's great.
Well, John Allen is here. We're at the Beaumont. It's all brought to you by the Maryland Lottery. M3 is up. So give a status of Stone Horses, give a status of Charm City, give a status of, like, all of these, no, not Charm City, but a Child's Play, and putting this thing together, because, like, Child's Play plays like twice a year, mm-hmm. but it's not like, hey Nick, we'll see you at the show, you know, just be there. I mean, this is an annual thing that you're doing now to honor Brian, I think, to bring Essex and Dundalk together and everybody that loves Baltimore.
Represent Baltimore, yeah.
Well, it really is. I mean, now the Kix is gone. I got a good Kix story for you. But now that it's over, you feel some responsibility in doing this thing and the M3 thing. Like, you become part of the furniture. And I know, I've known him a while. This was important to you to be on the M3 thing, right? Like, it went on for 20 years. Like, then you're like, I want to play that, right?
Yeah, it only took 13 years for them to put us on. But no, yeah, it's great. It's you know, it's an honor for the band to be included on the M3 festival and on the stage. I mean, we're on Saturday.
People get there early to see you. I know, I've been that guy a couple of times, right?
Yeah. It's great because the first time we were on even earlier than we're going to be on this Saturday, and people got there early. So yeah, so we get together and we rehearse the shows, you know, beforehand. I mean, we're not just showing up. We're putting time in to kick off some, you know, knock the rust off and everything.
No offense to you, but it always shows with Nick to me.
Yeah.
When Nick plays, like, it's very obvious he's in a zone to playing because he's not out playing every day, right? Like, in a general sense, he has to pick the instrument back up, get familiar with things, get comfortable. I mean, I see this with Tommy Conwell's band last week. Like, they're a band from the 80s. They play twice or three times a year. Tommy's like, it's like riding, you know, they sound check on the day of the show. They walk in the day of the show, and they run the whole set. Mm-hmm. I watch them do it down at Dewey Beach. I don't know how every band does it, but I think for fans to show up and say, Child's Play, we're here, you know, like, and it feels like effortless for you. And for when we hear the songs, I mean, those songs, but I'm like, it's not effortless. I know you, and it's just not easy to do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like, we don't play that much, and we hadn't done it for a long time, especially right before Brian passed. We weren't playing hardly at all. We hardly did any. We had done some reunion shows, and it sort of ran its course, and we stopped. And now Nick and I, you know, were doing Charm City Devils, so we were still playing, but I wasn't playing drums. You know, on the M3 show, I'll sing for the first half. Since Brian passed, and then the second
Larry,
yeah, and then the second half we bring Larry Henshaw out, the original singer for Child's Play.
You have such history with these guys, man. It's a beautiful thing. It really is.
It is. We get together and we, you know, talk about the old days and the old clubs and, you know, the stories.
But that transcends to people like me that were in your orbit, in your space at that point. And I damn well forgot. I brought these for Chad Weisling because I had. I have your liner notes. You thanked me on the Child's Play liner notes.
Nice.
When Jack Dean, you know, wrote, I'm not the first one, even though it's Aparici with the A, but I'm among the people that you thanked back in the day. So I don't know how many people are still alive or all of us. We would try to get together, but I think this is sort of a homecoming. It's a bit of a Hammerjacks reunion, really. I mean, that's what M3, yeah. right? I mean, and it's something you've attended. It's something you've gone to as a fan. And I saw something. So I've known John longer than he wants to admit that I've known him. But back when we were kids, he came to school one day and he said, "There's this great band, man. They're on MTV. They're unbelievable. They're called, now look, it's ACCEPT, but it's not accept. It's accept. And they got this drummer." And he's like, "Double bass." You told me all this back when we were kids. You're on a bill with them this week, right?
We are on a bill with them, yeah. I don't remember this instance that yet.
You introduced me to so many rock bands. You were the reason that I saw Def Leppard doing, you know, Let It Go and High and Dry, and that you were like first on that.
Yeah.
But Accept was a band I only knew about because of you. Yeah. And I remember seeing their album in Highland Town right behind the Saxon albums and all the other hard metal, as John Steadman would say. But you don't remember this.
I don't remember telling you about it, but I remember buying that first. It was
Balls to the Wall.
No, it was Restless and Wild was my first Accept record. And it was great. The cover were two flying Vs, like, balanced together, and they were in flames up against a black background.
And you don't remember introducing me to this?
I don't, you know.
I was moved by this, because before you got here, I went through, I'm like, who's on M3? All right, we got to Sebastian Bach and Accept. I bet John doesn't remember that he told me about Accept.
I don't. You know, and it shames me to say this, but I didn't discover Metallica or Raven until Doug Bennett.
Doug introduced everybody to music.
He was in our homeroom, and he brought in the cassettes, and he said, "Here, check this out." And he handed me the Metallica cassette and the Raven cassette.
Because he saw your hair, and he knew.
I don't know what it was.
That's so beautiful that you mentioned Doug Bennett. You just dropped it. You know, Doug was one of my best friends. I think of him all the time because he was such a music head.
Yeah.
Every time I hear Depeche Mode, every time I hear The Cure, those bands that were. But he was also, you know, his family. He helped me develop my musical taste as a friend for, you know, all of our childhood, because he did the same thing for me that he did for you.
Did he grow up in Colgate?
He grew up in Berkshire.
Okay.
Eastwood, Colgate, Berkshire. You got to be east side to know. But he was a guy. He was my roommate for a while. But I have so many moments with him where he walked in the door with the album of Def Leppard, not the one that took him 5 years to get when the drummer lost his arm. Was the album?
Hysteria?
Hysteria. Thank you. He brought Hysteria in, and I remember him putting it on an album. We were roommates at the time. He's like, "Listen to this, Mutt Lang. Every song on this album's going to be a hit. Every song." And I think Women was the first release, maybe was the first single, or I mean, maybe. And I'm like, I don't hear it, Doug. You know, I don't. This might kill their career. It took them 5 years. Their drummer's got one arm. What do I know, right? What do I know?
Well,
right?
It didn't. If I didn't know this, but like going back and watching documentaries, it didn't really start to take off until they released
Pour Some Sugar on Me, right? And so, it was probably 8 or 9. I mean, it was. That may have been my third single or something like that.
I think it was second, but still, I mean, yeah, they went deep on that record. There were a lot of singles on that album, man. Almost every song on that record
was
a single.
But he said it the first time he laid the needle on the album. And, I, you know, 40 years later, I'm still like, the fact that you mentioned him, he should have worked in the music business, man. That would have been his place, you know?
Yeah.
But he handed you Metallica on cassette for the first time.
Yep, yeah.
How'd that change your life?
Not well. So I'm really bad at predicting the future, you know, and whatever. I came from a real like Deep Purple. I like Def Leppard, like you said. I guess more commercial at that time. And I remember
you were Priest, is what
Priest,
you were, right?
Priest as well. I really liked the Four Horsemen, and there were two songs back to back. It was Four Horsemen and another, and those were my favorite tracks off the record. But a lot of it, I thought was too heavy, you know. And I actually gravitated more towards the Raven record. Never buy stock tips, you know, according to me, you know. Like I was telling the story the other day. Same thing with Guns N' Roses. So I was in L.A. when that record came out, and it was everywhere, and they were just the huge buzz band in Los Angeles, and it was like, they're going to be huge, they're going to be huge. I came back to the East Coast, went to the record store, bought the record, I listened to it, you know. I mean, it came out in August of 87.
That album took a while to break.
Yeah, and I listened to it, I remember, and I was like, this is really cool, man. Too bad they're not going to be huge.
Little do we know.
It took a year and a half, 2 years, and bam, you know, it's just an amazing, amazing band, amazing record.
What was your gateway then? Deep Purple, you would say that's the middle. So for me, you know, there was Kiss.
It was Kiss
and
first,
then Aerosmith.
Those were my two bands.
And then Van Halen. Yeah, and you were instrumental in the Van Halen thing. You were one of the kids that had tickets to the 80, 81. You went to those shows, mm-hmm. and I don't say I didn't get Van Halen. I sort of got it. It was a really hard ticket to go to that show. Mm-hmm. But I got onto that a little bit more like, have you seen Junior's Grades? You know, like, mm-hmm. I wasn't necessarily You Really Got Me, 77, 78.
Yeah.
I was a little later to that, I think. I think that was more... Yeah, I just wasn't on that early. But I was on something early as a music critic, because you mentioned Raven or Metallica, who's going to make it or whatever. Mm-hmm. I was on Live early, the band Live.
Okay.
And I saw Tommy Conwell and the Young Rumblers up at the Chameleon Club, which is now the Village in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And I was in there one time, and I'm looking around, I'm like, I was here one time. It was like a lifetime ago. And I went to the bathroom, and the place has all of the old flyers mounted to the wall, you know, like it's like wallpaper. And I went up, and I'm looking for Live, and there it is, December 29th, 1991. Hmm. You know, it's the flyer. I took a picture of it while I was there, and I'm like, time and space. And I was with Mark Messina. He's like, did they play here on the way up or on the way down? And I said, they were kind of like there when they played it. They were like this huge band that was playing a Christmas show at home, mm-hmm. because they were all home for Christmas. Mm-hmm. And it was like the Poison show at Hammerjacks that was sort of the infamous. They were on a big, big tour and were playing one night in one club because they knew somebody or they did it on the way up. But I think about those bands that make it versus not make it. Do you have any elixir for why that happens or why it happened?
Hey, man, if I knew, you know, I'd be a millionaire many times over. No, I don't. There's so many things that I think can go wrong from the very inception of, like, you know, you've got a kernel of a song idea to you present it to the band, and some, you know, the band can mess it up, and then if they don't mess it up,
the producer will
mess it up, right? If the producer doesn't mess it up, maybe the mixer will mess it up, or maybe the master guy will mess it up, and then the record, you turn it into the label, and then, oh my gosh, you know, like, maybe the label will get it, maybe they won't.
Or it's like Billy Joel's Turnstiles, where they just turn everything up a half a step, and he hears it for the first time, and he's like, oh my God, they recorded it the wrong speed. Like, literally, that's a true story for him.
Oh, yeah.
Where his voice sounds like that, you know,
they
sped it up.
Yeah, yeah.
And he found it out in the final master. So, I mean, you hear these horror stories about bands getting ripped off and all that, but just the art form of Guns N' Roses having an album that sat there for 8 months before it broke and that might not have broke, and then other, I don't know, in the modern era, the American Idol era, and discovering bands and artists and why certain bands.
Yeah.
But the business has changed. You've seen the business change three or four times from Chrysalis as a kid to where you are now touring with Live Nation giving you bonus money to stay out on the road and play, right?
Right. I mean, like, you know, from my experience, like, it always seemed like the bands that got signed by the president of the label or somebody very high up were the priorities. That's what we were always under the impression that, you know, there were bands that were signed that were going to be the priority bands, and then there were bands that, you know, God knows why, you know, they got a deal, maybe because somebody at the label really liked them. But then, you know, maybe they turned in a record that was just undeniable. I don't know the Guns N' Roses story. I know their A&R guy, you know, signed them, and I think they went out there and they really just killed people on the road. Like, I saw them here at Hammerjacks, and they were phenomenal. And they also started doing press where they were like, they were the bad boys of rock and roll. Every story that I read in Spin magazine, it was about them, you know, having fights or whatever.
Well, it's like Ozzy biting the head off the bat, right?
Right.
Literally.
Yeah. And
show
and,
business, baby.
And they had a great record. They had a fantastic, undeniable record. So, you know, that's the elixir, right? All that. I mean, Child's Play we were signed originally by the president of the record label. We thought, man, we got it made. And we were in the studio here in Baltimore recording our debut album when we got word that they fired the president of our label. And we were like, uh-oh. You know, and then our manager was like,
we thought we were priority. Right.
Right? And our manager was like, don't worry about it. The vice president, Jeff Aldridge, he loves the band too, so we're fine. 2 months later, they fired him too.
Did I meet him on the boat that night? Was he on the love
boat? No, he was gone by then. So we were like, okay, great. You know, so that happens a lot with bands. They become orphans, you know, at labels. You know, sometimes it's the president, the vice president. Sometimes it's the guy that signed you, the A&R guy. So it's a miracle that anybody has success in the music business.
Well,
really,
I mean, I think about sometimes. Poison with you because they opened for you at the Seagull, right? When they were kids.
Well, it was an all ages show. They already had a record deal. We did not. They had their record deal, and they were really smart, man. They came around, they got a Winnebago, and they went across the United States, and they opened for every band
that was already kind of making it a little bit.
That was doing well in each market. So in Maryland.
Boy, that's smart, right?
It was really smart. They opened for Kix. They opened for Wrathchild. They opened for us. And it was really smart. And they went out, and they had these flyers. We had never seen a band do this before. And it had all their tour dates on it.
And in Philly, they opened for Cinderella. And in Boston,
probably,
they opened for whatever those bands were,
probably,
right?
And they had their phone number, you know, hotline number on there. And they had a mailing address that you could, you know, write to them. And
they had their ish together.
And they really did. Right. They went out, and they –
That's
they,
interesting. I've never talked to you about this because I've often wondered, like, why did they make it and not you? I mean, they had songs. Talk Dirty. They had great songs. They had a guitar player that they had some flash. And you know, I mean, Bret Michaels is still Bret Michaels for that. So, I mean, I'm not denying them. But they were no different than you at one point, right?
Well,
I mean, like all of those bands in the 80s.
They went to L.A. You know, that helped, I think, a lot. They said goodbye to Pennsylvania, and they went to Los Angeles. And they were in the thick of it when if you want to call hair metal started to on its
the sunset
ascent,
strip, right? Yeah.
And you know, and they worked hard, man. I gotta give them kudos. Like that after that first record, they came back with "Ain't Nothing But a Good Time." That song is a smash,
right?
You know, and when I heard it, I was like, okay, all right,
they're a party band.
Cheers to you guys,
yeah,
man.
Right.
I like it. It was, you know, respect, you know. But
and 40
yeah.
years later, you still turn it up.
Yeah, it's a great tune.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it reminds me of all the stuff that I grew up loving. Like,
I love Fallen
like
Angels. You know, I like all those songs still when I hear them. I'm old enough now that I don't really need to hear, like, I love Bon Jovi. We were talking about that earlier. You opened for Bon Jovi for a whole tour, but I don't really want to hear Dead and Alive or Living on a Prayer. I'm more about, like, Without Love or Raise Your Hands or you know, the off tracks to me all these years later, because I've been in the radio thing, I don't put those, they're not part of my play mix. I just get those when I'm out. I'm going to hear Living on a Prayer today whether I want to or not, You Give Love a Bad Name. But I just think the depth of those catalogs in the 80s for me, going down and saying I like not the hits as much, and I think that gives depth to the band as much as a hit would all these years later.
Well, yeah. I mean, we grew up in an era where, you know, you listen to a record. You listen to the whole album. You know, sometimes you
put rock.
Yeah, you dropped a needle on it, and you were like, okay, I get I love the single. That's why I bought the record. And I don't really get what's going on the rest of it. And you had to, like, you listened to it a few times, and you started to understand where the artist was coming from. You started to get the band, you know. And, that doesn't really happen, you know.
It's over.
Yeah.
Well, when I was the music critic during your era, like 86 to 92, I told the story earlier in the week because we said, who likes going out and getting mail? I'm like, oh, I love getting mail on Kane Street back in the 80s because all the record companies would send me first albums and then CDs to the door. So I would have – Doug Bennett was living with me. He'd go out and get the boxes. I'd come home. He'd be opening my boxes, spinning stuff. Hey, this sounds good. New Metallica's good or whatever. But I did, at that point in my life, take it so seriously that when the CD would come, even if it's Pretty Boy Floyd, right? Didn't matter it was. Black Crowes were another band. I'll never forget getting that Black Crowes CD, because it was a CD.
The first
and
record.
I dropped it in, and I heard the first three chords of Twice as Hard.
Fantastic.
And I'm like, what is this Rod Stewart, Aerosmith, Stonesy thing going on? And then you listen to the whole album. And for me, as the music critic, I would give it 45 minutes. If I got a new piece, I would listen to the new Genesis album, the new Rush album, Hold Your Fire, things I didn't even like, and would just give it that first spin. I don't know that I did that as a kid. Maybe I brought Foreigner 4 home and dropped it down and played it, you know, as or Journey, Escape when I was a kid and dropped it on the turntable, or even Rush, like listening to Red Barchetta, listening to the Moving Pictures. But I didn't listen. In the 80s, it changed me for what all of you were trying to do and saying, it's a body of work, listen to it all the way through. And as a music critic for 6 years, I listened to everything, and it was first, it was like eating, like that jerk that eats the pizza and takes one bite and throws it away and says it's good or it's bad. Mm-hmm. I felt that way about the albums. Like, I give it one spin through. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, not against depth of listening to it and before I judge it, but just to get a vibe on it, I would have to listen to the whole thing. I guess my point is, I wasn't like track one, track three, track five. No, no, no. The whole way through, because that's the way the bands wanted it mm-hmm. presented. It was your art. That's how I looked at it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's definitely a lost art to not be able to do that now for
you don't think
the,
that way,
listener.
Do you? Like, as a musician, you're trying to put a song out, right? You're trying to drop a single.
Well, I don't always, like, what I do is I come up with an idea, and I try to make that song as good as it possibly can be, and I'll work it and sometimes maybe overwork it or whatever, but for a couple of weeks, you know, I'll hone that idea. And it's always with the thought that I'm trying to make the song as good as possible. And one of my approaches, and it's probably not the right one, is that I always come from a live background. Like, is this song going to rock live, you know? Like,
because I'm not making it for... You're making it to sing it on a stage, right?
Yeah,
literally,
I mean,
right?
That's where I come from, and for good or for bad, you know, that's how.
You don't
that's,
think like a studio guy.
Yeah,
in that
I don't
way,
think
right.
you know.
Okay.
And maybe I might go back later and like change the arrangement to go like, okay, so for radio, we got to get to the vocal quicker. You know, like maybe we can swap something out.
But this would
know,
be a good song to stretch out on stage. Make it different on stage.
Yeah, we don't really stretch out. You know,
okay.
But actually, you know, with Stone Horses, we do have the musicianship now that in this band that can do that, and it's really cool. You know,
How long has the band been stable for you with the same guys?
So this lineup has been together since last summer with my original guitar player coming back into the fold.
Okay.
We have a phenomenal bass player playing with us right now, Dylan House, and Teddy Merrill on guitar. Just like this whiz kid that I met when he was like 16 or 17. He was with School of Rock, and they opened for Charm City Devils at Soundstage, and he had this big head of hair, and I was like, that kid's got something on stage, and and then he wound up filling in for both Nick and then Victor on the last Charm City Devils tour. Like, one of them couldn't make the first half, and then the other one couldn't make the second half, so he filled in for each guy. Yeah. So anyway, so those are kind of my approaches to writing songs, you were talking about, you know, listening to a whole record. I'll never forget when I was gifted Draw the Line. Aerosmith
okay.
record.
79?
I don't know.
Go ahead.
Sounds about right, right? And, you know, I didn't know from anything. The first song, the title cut, it's like a drop tune song, open tuning for Joe to do the slide guitar part on it. And it's already kind of got this kind of drunk kind of feel. Well, my record was warped. I didn't realize. So it was really.
Did you leave it on the heater? Remember we used to have the.
I didn't discover that until I had Mob Rules by Sabbath, and it was also warped.
How did Ronnie James Dio sound warped?
It was
warped.
Cool. It was cool. Ronnie James Dio could never sound bad, so no matter warped, not warped, he was fantastic. I accidentally left it on the turntable, which was right underneath my bedroom windows. My room faced the south. So I left it on the turntable for like a week one summer, flattened the thing out, man. It was perfect after that week. I put the needle on. It was a surprise. I had no idea. I was like, oh,
I saw that tour at the arena, the Mob Rules tour.
I did too.
John Allen, we did it all together. John Allen's here from Stone Horses. M3's getting going at Merriweather next week. They are kicking off Saturday. David Lee Roth, Sebastian Bach. By the way, in this restaurant here, Donnie McCafferty, who will be here a little later on, whose grandfather was the Super Bowl V head coach for the Colts and won the Super Bowl. I came in about 3 months ago with because my wife and I, we sit right where Chad's sitting. We usually sit right over there because I stand when I eat. I'm like a horse, stone horse. He said to me, the other night, Sebastian Bach walked in here and sat at that table with his band and ate steaks. And he's like, I said to him, how did you find out about us? He's like, oh, we were over at the airport and we Googled and said, you're the best restaurant in the area. Nice. So we came over. And he said it was really quiet in here. There weren't a lot of people here that night. He said he sat over there. Couldn't have been the best. He was the best guy ever. Mm-hmm. So when Donnie comes, Sebastian Bach has dined here in the last 6 months. So
nice.
He's playing. I don't know anything about him other than when they opened, Skid Row opened for Bon Jovi. He just used F-bombs on stage a lot. Remember, he was very effed up at that point. But he has had this incredible longevity. We talk about people of that era in MP3 to open up. There's another guy there that had a band of that era that did some good things, but not Bon Jovi things, but still good enough, like Twisted Sister last year and Dee Snider, that people don't forget this stuff. And Bach's a working musician to this day.
He is, yeah. I mean, Skid Row, I mean, think about like how many – they had a lot of hits. You know, like that first record had like,
I remember three or four hits. You know, an eternal song.
Oh, it's incredible. And then the second record as well. So, yeah, so Sebastian kicks off the Friday night at M3, and then
maybe he'll be in for dinner here Thursday. Maybe. I know he knows where this is.
He'll come back.
Yeah,
come
absolutely.
Back. But yeah, so then Saturdays, you know, us and the lineup, like you said, it was David Lee Roth headlining. Except,
are you going to meet the guys in Except and tell them how much you loved them when you were a kid? Is it still have the same drummer that you loved or no? I don't know.
I think that it is.
Well, you should
drummer.
Go give that guy love.
I know, you should.
You should tell him that you. I know this to be true. If you don't remember it, I remember it.
You remember everything. That first record with the not first record, Restless and Wild, the first record I purchased with the double kick drum and the
double kick drum. There it is.
The first song, I was blown away.
I didn't even know what the hell that was.
My brain was like. And, it was a big deal.
I'm glad I reminded you of that because that would be something in life. And you would have said to me at that point in our lives that you would one day have your band open for – you would be like,
yeah,
you would accept that life. You would think that's good, right?
Yeah.
Well, Chad's here. He is an agent to the Stars and Josh Jacobs. He's headed to the NFL draft next week in Green Bay. Take a jacket. And John Allen is here. I'm going to have him sit together because he's a Hagerstown. With rock and roll, but for both of you, I'll end with this and begin with this. I went to see Tommy Conwell and the Young Rumblers at the Chameleon Club in Lancaster the other night, and Mark Messina and I were in the back quiet room catching up because we're old farts talking about his brother and pitching and life and all that. And the band's coming on. We're like, "All right, let's go out." We go down into the pit, and it was a little bit like a VFW club. It had like a sunken disco thing on the floor and a stage. We go down to the front. And we're there 1 minute, and Tommy comes out, "Here I come," you know. And we look up, and there's a dude right in front of Tommy. And I have video of this, wearing a kick shirt. Mm-hmm. All I looked at for 2.5 hours of Tommy playing was this dude in the front with a kick shirt with his arms up. All we saw was kicks and Tommy Conwell all night. So there's a Hagerstown guy over there.
There you go.
You talked to Whiteman lately? How's he doing? How's his retirement?
I haven't talked to him lately.
I ain't retired.
I watched him. So our last guitar player, Justin Parks, his dad owns a record store up there in Hagerstown, and he does a podcast, and Steve was on it a few weeks ago.
What's he doing?
Telling stories. He's enjoying his retirement. What's he doing?
Well, they should come back and shake their ass for me next week with you. You know, if you could shake your ass, he can shake his hair off.
How's he look?
Younger.
He looks good.
Well, you know I love Steve. You know?
I do too, man.
Steve, I need you today, man. I've been doing too much talking. I did beer and bots last night. Like,
did you take vocal lessons from him?
Me. Do you think that? Yes, of course he taught me that. Why would I do that? Why would I do something so stupid if he didn't teach me that?
The old pigeon.
Sing down here in the diaphragm. You got to warm up. You got to warm up your voice. I'm warming my voice up. When I sing, you think I just go out there and sing like this?
Well, maybe that's not bad. Maybe he's doing vocal lessons.
I'm hurting. I went into a room. I was talking all night, and then I emceed this thing where like I didn't have any monitor. I'm screaming into the mic, don't realize it, and then I heard my own self this morning on my radio station, and Luke and I were talking about the game last night. I'm like, hey, Luke. I sound like I smoked like a pack or three before I went on the air. Mm-hmm. I don't like that. I'm not going to talk over the weekend. I'm going to pretend I'm in a band riding around the Midwest. Stone Horses. He is John Allen. They are Charm City Devils. They are SR71, and they will be Child's Play. And did I forget a band?
Yeah. No.
Was there one more?
I think you got them all.
You were never an Honor Among Thieves. You were never with Mitch, even though you were with Mitch.
Yeah.
But that was SR71.
Yep.
And then there was Charm City Devils. I got that one.
Yep.
And now Stone Horses.
Yep.
That's it.
Sort of, yeah.
You were in Gina Shock's band for 5 minutes, too. Yeah. Go-Go's are doing their thing next month.
Yes.
We saw her, but both of us have interacted with her. So rock and roll is alive. It's not dead. M3. Why do I keep calling it MP3? Why do I say that? I know better. It's at Merriweather Post Pavilion. That's what it is. MPP. M3. We're at Beaumont. We're giving away these Back to the Future $10,000. One day I hope somebody wins more than $100, but I'm going to be doing that next week. We'll be at Cooper's North in Timonium, and then we're going to be on the 30th at Coco's Pub, and then on the 7th in White Marsh at Red Brick Station. We're coming back. Chad Weeksing's going to be here. We're going to do nothing but heavy metal in the next segment. Yes. And then we're going to do NFL draft. And also, former Councilman Quirk is going to be here talking about money and tariffs and Donald Trump. I'll hide my head and my soul. Back for more from Catonsville. We're at the Beaumont. We are Baltimore Positive. Stay with us.